Hey, it's Mistress Carrie reporting for duty from MCHQ for episode 129 of the Mistress Carrie podcast. And before we get to this week's guest, Sam Carter from Architects, I wanted to remind you about all of the new gear you can find in the online store at MistressCarrie.com. You can outfit your bar with the 7-in-1 bartender tool and a new set of coasters, plus pint glasses, shot glasses, and beer koozies. And finally, the fitted caps, visors, and trucker hats are in. And make sure you check out the store at MistressCarrie.com coming up on Black Friday for the huge Black Friday sale. So if you want to listen to AC/DC and have a mistress for Christmas, you can check out the online store at MistressCarrie.com. Back in October, I was in Vegas celebrating my birthday, and I also went to a bunch of music events and concerts. One of the events was a listening party for the new Architects album, The Classic Symptoms of a Broken Spirit. And while I was there, I got to sit down just for a couple minutes and talk to Architects lead singer Sam Carter, who had just landed from the UK and gave me some very sage birthday celebrating advice. I tried to take it, but was unsuccessful, by the way. I asked Sam if he would come on the podcast. He said yes, and he made good on the promise. Sam and I talked about Vegas and COVID. We talked about being a politically outspoken band, his new hobby of running, mental health, his pets that he rescued from Romania, the upside of social media, how every band ends up like Spinal Tap, our shared love of the Beatles, and so much more. Matter of fact, we had such a good time talking that, well, I kept him late. Sorry, Sam. So allow me to introduce you to Sam Carter from Architects.
Hey, what's up? This is Sully from Godsmack. Strap on those boots, baby, because you are now in the trenches of the war room with the one and only Mistress Carrie right here on the Mistress Carrie podcast.
What's up? This is Joe Rogan, and you're listening to Mistress Carrie.
Her hair is so lovely. With the eyes.
Hey, this is Brent from Shinedown, and you're listening to Mistress Carrie. Hey, Carrie, go put your bra on, girl.
Hey, this is Steven Tyler, and you be listening to the baddest bitch in Boston, Mistress Carrie.
What's up? This is Aaron from and you're listening to Mistress Carrie.
Hi, everybody. This is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, and you're listening to the one, the only Mistress Carrie.
Hey, this is David from the band Disturbed. You're listening to the baddest bitch in Boston, Mistress Carrie.
Hi, Bruce Dickinson here from Iron Maiden. Yes, indeed. Miss Whiplash herself, Mrs. Carrie, is here to unchain your brain.
Hi, this is Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You're listening to Mistress Carrie.
This is Dennis Leary. You are listening to my favorite, Mistress Carrie.
Hey, this is Corey from Stone Sour, and you're listening to... You have the privilege of listening to Mr. Scary.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
Sam, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very well, thank you. Very well. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to see you again. I saw you in Vegas at the album listening party.
Yeah, that was a good time.
You gave me advice that I should, because my birthday was that weekend, that I should just start drinking at that moment and not stop drinking till I got off the plane.
And did you listen?
Almost. It's hard to consume alcohol while you're sleeping, but if there was a way, I would have done it. So
there, I mean, if there was a way, it's Vegas. I'm sure they could probably put it into your AC or something.
Yeah, I'm sure. They'll vaporize it and just have you wear an oxygen mask with alcohol vapors in it or
exactly.
Something. Yeah.
Sounds like a good time in Vegas. Anything goes.
It was. So thank you for being part of my crazy birthday weekend. And it was nice to get a chance to hear the whole album with you there. Was that weird for you?
It was, yeah, it's interesting. I think at the start I was like, oh my God, this is so nerve-wracking, you know. And then actually it was really nice, I think, to just meet everyone that has been supporting the band and be able to just say thank you, you know. It's so interesting for us, and especially for me, to like actually see it, because, you know, American radio is just this whole other beast of you know, amazing radio stations in every single state. You know, in the UK it's like, you have a few, probably like if you have a few radio stations, but they're not as big as the ones that are in America that are like giant in their own state, and everyone's pushing all these, you know, amazing bands. It was, yeah, just nice to actually see people and be able to say thank you for like supporting our band and being able to put like a face to a name and actually be able to be like, we genuinely appreciate you taking, you know, shots on our band. It really does mean a lot to us. So yeah, it was nice to be able to convey that thanks to people properly, you know, which can get lost over an email or a tweet or whatever, like be able to look into the whites in someone's eyes and be like, it really means a lot, you know?
And talk about kind of one extreme to the other, right? You go from everything that happened with COVID and kind of being forced to just hunker down and kind of deal with all of that. And then, mm-hmm. Oh, now you're thrust into Vegas.
Yeah.
And back you're on tour again.
Yeah, you're out into America for 3 days and then you come back and then you're back to work and everything's, yeah, back to recording and back to, yeah, getting ready for sessions at home and then going out on tour next week. And yeah, it's been really nice, actually. I think so much of our world and of like touring bands' worlds and lives just changed overnight. I mean, everyone's lives changed, of course, but there was just we were the last ones back, really, you know, musicians. It was sort of like our job is playing to crowds, and that was a thing that was a no-no for a while. So yeah, just a lot of walking the dogs and, you know, being grateful for my health. And then, yeah, now it's time to rock and roll again.
And especially, I think, for rock fans, those live shows, I think, are more of our lifestyle than maybe other genres of music, where if you're a rock and metal fan, the live shows are, they're just part of your lifestyle. And so having those taken away from the fans was really hard for us, too, because that's where all the freaks get together.
Yeah. It's kind of like a therapy for a lot of people. I think it's a room of people that feel quite similar, and you can go together and express, you know, how you're feeling, and also have a band that and bands that understand how you're feeling as well, and just engage in that. Yeah, I guess that positive energy in a room, you know, everyone's sort of releasing, you know, the demons and stuff that they have by jumping around, and, you know, you always feel better after a run. So I'm sure you feel better after a mosh, you know.
And, you know, with the way the world is politically now, it seems to be one of those things where you can go into a rock show still. Sometimes, no, depending on the artist or whatever. But for the most part, you kind of leave all of that stuff outside, because what we all want is to experience the music together.
Well, I think also if you look at everything and you get too bogged down in politics, you know, we're a very outspoken band, and we talk about things that we care about and you know, we always have done. But I think it's kind of hard because everything's hard. You know, there's no right or wrong answer either way. It's just like, I think sometimes it's quite nice just to get everyone in a room together and go, huh, it's pretty rubbish, huh? You know, and just be like, you want to just enjoy some music and have some rock and roll and have a good time. I think that's where we're at. And I think that's, you know, what's important is people kind of, you know, people have different political views, I think. And, you know, sometimes you might not agree with something that someone says that doesn't necessarily make them an awful person. You know, I think, and sometimes it's good to be able to engage in that conversation. But I think really kind of where the world's at, you can't really just have a normal chat anymore. Everything seems kind of too aggy. So let's just enjoy some rock and roll and have a good time while we can.
I talked to Zach Blair from Rise Against about this, because they've always been an outspoken band as well. Is it getting harder for bands that have strong opinions? Is it scarier? Is it harder? Or does it galvanize you and make you, you know, more driven to speak out about the things that matter to you?
I think you're always going to have angry people that want to have a go at you. I think they've always been there, and there's always people that just disagree with you and want to take sort of personal shots at you because of that. I just think it's mainly important to just not rise to it and just understand that, you know, treat people with the sort of respect that you'd want to be treated with. You know, we take a lot of shots for a lot of the stuff that we do and things that we talk about, and even the sound of our band sometimes annoys people, you know. So I think it's just key to just try and be kind, you know, try and put some kindness back in there. You know, two wrongs doesn't make any rights. And if someone's already that angry, they're not going to enjoy you coming back at them and being angry. So you just got to be like, peace, it's all good.
You talked about having time to walk the dogs. When you were kind of forced to quote unquote, be on vacation because of COVID, just unable to tour and do what you do best. What did you find joy in besides obviously walking the dogs? Did you discover a new hobby, learn a new language or anything? What were you doing?
Other than sort of finishing off the record and writing the record, yeah, mainly I got really into running, enjoyed running. And I say I enjoyed running. I didn't know one really enjoys it. It's just the sort of feeling afterwards where you go like, oh, I feel like I've done something. other than that, you know, just trying to spend a bit of time in nature and sort of getting outside. We're very lucky. I live right by the sea, so I can sort of walk down there. And, you know, the English weather sort of gives you something different every day. You know, it normally rains at one point, but you know, it's, you know, you go down there, it's like a different day every time you get down there. So
it's
yeah,
kind of how it is here in
home.
New England too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably why it's called it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I know what you mean about, go ahead.
No. Yeah. So just enjoying, trying to take the positives from it, you know, and trying to just enjoy the time and just hold on to the thought that it will all come back, you know, and the sort of normality will resume. You just, there's no point in wishing or rushing it because I didn't have control, you know.
I ran the Boston Marathon a few years ago, which growing up in Boston, it's kind of that Everest, right? That you just want to do it once, kind of check it off your bucket list thing. And in training for that, especially in the wintertime here in New England, when you talk about not enjoying running at all, it's still like I will never, ever run the marathon ever again. Most miserable experience ever. So glad I did it.
Yeah.
Can't believe
you can say you've done it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I used to make the joke that unless a zombie was chasing me with a hatchet, you wouldn't catch me running for fun. What is it about running? It's like signing up for personal torture.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's like the thing with the band, and I think that I always like when I'm on tour, I think is, and I sleep well on tour is because I feel like I've accomplished something with my day. I feel like there's been that like hit of adrenaline. So I think when we were home for that amount of time, I was like, I can't just sit around anymore. Like I have to do something. And I used to go to the gym, but it didn't really tire me out as much as running. And I always avoided cardio, like the plague, like you say, and was not interested.
That anymore. We can't even say avoid it like the plague anymore.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Avoid it like COVID. I didn't think I could do it. That was also a thing. I never thought that I could do a kilometer, let alone 5 or 10 or whatever. Ali that's in the band, he'd been doing it for a while and was like, you should try this and gave me a load of tips. And before I knew it, I was just running and enjoying records. You know, it was a time to put my AirPods on and just run along the beach and just get to know albums and spend more time listening to music and podcasts and just getting the blood pump around your body and just it's been so good for my mental health. That's the main reason why I always try and stay on top of it. It's like if I stop doing it for a while, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm starting to feel a bit you know tetchy. I need to get out for a run, and it always seems to have the answer.
Do you go running when you're out on the road through whatever city you're in?
We have done, yeah. I mean, I haven't since we've been on tour, since I've started probably doing it, but it's definitely something that I'm going to do and try and keep up. Again, you have so many hours in the day. It's good to do something to feel good about yourself and stay healthy and know that you can, you know, give the best possible show.
I never would have asked this question, and then it came up in conversation with Geezer Butler from Black Sabbath. So I blame him for asking you this question, but we started talking about his animals and he dropped the little nugget of information that he names all of his animals after gangster rappers. And ever since then, I have to ask everybody what their dogs and cats' names are because Geezer Butler changed the world for me, knowing that all of his animals are named after people like Missy Elliott. It changed
That's
everything.
So good.
Yeah, exactly.
So good. Yeah, I have Sophia, who's she's a little rescue dog from Romania. And she looks like a little fox, but she was called Sophia when I got her. I got her name tattooed on me. I love her. And my other dog is called Lucky. And I found Lucky when I was on tour in Romania. She was outside our tour bus and she was looking really ill. And we managed to get her back home. And now she lives in England with me. And she was really ill. She was really close to, she was like a week away from dying. And that's why she's called Lucky, because she, you know, she came and found the tour bus, and then she, it was a whole ordeal, but she's in England. She's been here for 3 years now. So yeah, I've got the two little rescue dogs.
I'm sure that was a really easy thing to get a dog from Romania into England.
It was insane. Sophia was really easy, because obviously they had all the charities and stuff set up so that they can come through. So it's quite common in the UK, because they have so many stray dogs over in Romania. But actually with Lucky, I had to try and find someone that would come and take her, because our bus was leaving the car park where she was at 5 a.m. For us to come home. And I wasn't able to take her on the bus. I tried to get her a hotel room, and the hotel wouldn't let me get her a hotel room. I tried to pay double for her to get a hotel room, and they said no. I spoke to the promoters. They said no. Everyone associated with the show said no, they couldn't help, because they just don't care about dogs, really. Not everybody, but everyone I spoke to didn't care about dogs. And then I had no option but to just tweet. I was like, if anyone is in Romania, came to our show tonight, if you could come and pick up this dog and look after it until 10 a.m. when this charity that I got my other dog through can come and pick her up, I'll be eternally in your debt. And a girl called Maria came and turned up, and she came and took Lucky and looked after her overnight. And then the charity came and picked her up and gave her the medication she needed and helped her sort of, you know, get some food and put some weight on. And then they brought her over to me. It was like the day before my birthday. So it was, amazing. Really amazing. But it was just nice. I couldn't leave her. She was just such a lovely dog, but she just wasn't eating and was so kind to every single member of our crew and band. So I just sat in the car park with her for 4 or 5 hours until we got everything sorted. And now she, now she pushes me off the sofa. So it's all good.
It is kind of amazing, with all of the negative things that come from social media, that good things can come of it too.
Yeah. It's amazing. That's the thing as well. Like, and you know, so many times with this band, we've raised so much money for, you know, important charities like Wonder Dog Rescue, Romanian Rescue Appeal, so many charities where you can kind of show, you know, a thing that you're passionate about and ask for help and show that these organizations need help and these charities need help. And our fans are always super supportive and always really, really, you know, dig in their pockets and give what they can. And more than they know, they've probably saved a lot of these organizations.
I've been to Romania once. I saw Judas Priest there in Bucharest before the pandemic. And I'd always heard that metal fans in that part of the world and hard rock fans in that part of the world were insane. And I got to experience it. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, they love it. They really love it. And it's the same. Europe is just metal heaven. You know, it's like there's so many amazing festivals that go on throughout the summer, and people just really, really care about music out there. And it's just, you know, so great to be in a band and to be able to go and do all these festivals and just see how much it means to everyone. It's just, a blessing. But they're up for it over there.
I always was envious of all of those big kind of metal and rock festivals in Europe. And it seems like slowly the United States is kind of creating those big benchmark festivals as well.
Yeah, it seems like that's happening now. You know, you see a lot of bands sort of putting their touring around it. You know, we were supposed to be there this year, and we were looking forward to playing a couple of those shows. But yeah, it looks like it's really coming on. You know, we were lucky to play a few years back before the pandemic as well. And it feels like that's always been an opportunity. I'm just not sure why it wasn't there, but now it feels like it is. You know, even things like, you know, like the Mayhem tour and Warped tour, you know, when we did that, I was amazed at how many people would come to these shows every day in across America. And I think, there's some big rock and big metal fans in America that will happily fill out, you know, a soccer stadium out there. And I got to see, we did a show and I went to go and see Papa Roach. Like, they were headlining one of the festivals, and it was in like the Columbus Crew Stadium, I think it was. I just remember just looking out as they were playing their set and just being like, there is so many fucking people here, just losing their minds. I loved it. So it's going to be cool to be able to come back and do them and at some point be able to, you know, climb up that list of bands as well.
I mean, it's not going to last because obviously, as you know, rock is dead, obviously. So,
Of course. Of course. Yeah. I always forget that.
Yeah, I mean, why are we even bothering? Because it's dead. Gene Simmons says it's dead, so it's obviously dead.
I feel like he just says it every time they have a tour or something. Yeah, like he must know at this point that it's going to get clipped up.
No,
and everyone's
this is the last tour. This is the last tour.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I always hear about it over here as well. And I think there was like I think it was 5 weeks in the UK where it was like, bring me us, Yumi at Six, and Shikari and Mogwai. And I think they were all in a row where we all had number one albums. And it was like, well, we're all rock bands. You know, we're all like metal and rock and hard rock bands. And I think I tweeted out at the time, I was like, oh, rock's dead, is it? Well, you've got to tell the UK because, you know, they're very much up for it. Yeah, I think there's so much great music out there now. And I think it's just getting rock and metal and punk and everything is just seemingly getting more and more popular. And especially in America, it seems like it's just blowing up at the moment. And every sort of new band that's coming through is super exciting. So, yeah, it's really good times.
I talk to a lot of bands and it's always really funny to talk about the ping pong ball of rock and how it's gone across the Atlantic from the US to the UK and back again with, you know, all of the bands that got inspired by all of the original blues and then all of the American artists that got inspired by all of the British artists. So can we talk about you growing up and what you were listening to growing up?
Just the Beatles, Zeppelin, the Stones, you know, which is, as you say, like all influenced by everything that was coming over from America. You know, the Beatles and bands like that were getting these records in Liverpool because there was a port in Liverpool where the big boats are coming from New York, and they would, you know, bring 7 inches over from there, and then they would hear about these bands and then they would start covering them. And yeah, so my life and my childhood was listening to the Beatles and the Stones and just, yeah, I'm very blessed to come from a family of people that you know, love the Beatles. You know, me and my dad still geek out over it. You know, my house is pretty much a museum to them, you know. So, yeah, it's amazing. I think really when you see, like you say, like the ping pong of things that sort of happened and started over here and then, you know, going over to America and like where folk started really kicking off, you know, with Bob Dylan and seeing everything evolve from there into like Sabbath and then, you know, it's just amazing, you know, sort of the trajectory of rock and roll and the history of it. And it's something that massively fascinates me, obviously, because, you know, I've grown up listening to it and, you know, hearing the stories of how it all started and why they started recording and what they were recording.
And how they were recording.
That's also the other thing that I love. You know, we've had the joy of being able to go to Abbey Road a few times and we've recorded a full album there with an orchestra. And we did that. We did that in Studio One, which is where the Beatles recorded all their strings and where they did the All You Need Is Love video and Day in the Life video. And, you know, I'm a Beatles nerd, so for me, you know, seeing that history is there. But what's so staggering about it is these bands were just going in and writing songs and having to remember them, not demo them, you know, go in and be like, if it's good enough, we'll remember it, and then track it perfectly and sound perfect and still be able to be played now. Up against, you know, bands that have all the tricks of the trade.
And, Pro Tools, you know, auto-tune, all of that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, John and Paul and the rest of the boys going in there and just, you know, writing songs that literally live in everyone's heads rent-free forever, you know?
I talked to Tyler Connolly from Theory of a Dead Man, and he recorded at that studio as well and went into the room where he was allowed to listen to some of the original Beatles masters. And he listened, he told me the story about listening to A Day in the Life. And he said that the guy at the studio told him, listen really carefully at the end of the song, turn it way, way up. And at the very end, you hear someone's chair turn and squeak and someone go, shh, and they left it in.
Yeah, it's so good. What's amazing is when you listen to that now, obviously A Day in the Life finishes with that massive piano hit. Whereas like, if you were to do that now, you would just have one piano and then just coat it in reverb and delays, right? But I think they had 10 or 12 pianos in that room and they all had to hit it at exactly the same time and have their foot on the sustain pedal and just sit there. And yeah, I love that. I love the sort of the element of just someone, you know, standing up or their chair creaking and being like, man, we just got that perfect. You know, like,
and then they're like
12 times today.
Screw it. We're not doing it again. Leave the squeak in there.
Yeah, I think after a while you're like, mate, we've spent so much money on tape. We can't keep going through this.
And of course, you know, the Spinal Tap thing, you know, it's like there's no,
yeah.
You can't bring up the word sustain and have Spinal Tap like not get brought up at all.
That's a big part of our history, of course. That's the biggest part. Let's leave the Beatles and the Stones and Zeppelin. You know, they're the real gods.
Yeah, just as long as we can keep Spinal Tap.
I think, but that's the thing, it's still so relevant. You know, there's so many things that you say on tour or on stage, or if you see, you know, a bit of production that you're trying to do that just hasn't worked out, and you just imagine it's just like the little tiny Stonehenge coming in, or just like, you know, walking or trying to find the stage door, like, hello, Cleveland, you know, it's all the same.
I just saw Aerosmith recently celebrate their 50th anniversary in Boston at Fenway Park. And they put a piano up on the Green Monster so that Steven Tyler can do Dream On. And they had issues with it. And every single person I was with made the Stonehenge joke from Spinal Tap.
And do you know what? It's such a relief to hear. I always find, you know, whenever you hear like a technical issue or something at a show, normally you would be like, oh, that's really shit. I feel so sorry for them. But every band goes through it. So when you hear it, you're like, it's not just us. It's not just us. There's some other band, some other poor sods running around, you know, trying their hardest to make it work. And you just, you're like
getting stuck in a cocoon.
Yeah, we just exactly. Or just exploding.
Yeah. And just left a little green globule on the stool. What's the worst thing that happened to you? Have you fallen off the stage? That seems to be the thing.
Yeah, I've been rugby tackled off stage before. That was in Prague. We were opening up for Underoath. This was probably 11 or 12 years ago. I ran out on stage and we were ringing out, waiting to, you know, kick in. And someone just ran from behind me to try and crowd surf and just took me off my riser. I just fell straight off the stage and just smashed my head on the floor. And then the next thing I know, I was just back on stage. And I was like, what the fuck just happened to me? and then someone was like, someone just ran into you. I was like, all right, cool. Just let's go
on with the show.
I think my friend came over and gave me a whiskey and Coke. And he was like, this should sort you out. And I just had it and was like, cool, let's go.
Yeah.
Start again.
I'll
stand up there again and wait for someone else.
Yeah.
It's my way out. It's my security.
So when you were growing up, like I had kind of the same thing, that my mom gifted me with a love of the Beatles. But obviously, I appreciated the music, but don't have the ability. So you're growing up listening to the Beatles with your dad. When did it go from just liking music to actually figuring out that you could do it?
I think I was around 12 or 13, and I started playing drums. And I just loved it. I loved it so much. You know, I had lessons, you know, once a week after school. And then, you know, gradually it was like, I can't wait all week to go and do that. You know, then you'd start playing drums on the end of your bed. And then it was like practice pads. And then, it's something about learning an instrument that, like, when you actually find the one that you love, it's not hard work. It's not like you have to rehearse, you have to do this. It was like, you just wanted to do it. You know, I remember when I first got my first ever drum kit, I'd worked like a year or 2 years to save up the money to afford this kit. You know, I was just doing a paper round. And then when I got it, I when it was in my room, I could barely sleep because I was just looking at it like, I cannot believe this is in my room. I'm like in love with this thing. And it just overtakes your life. And then you start almost in a weird way, it sounds crazy, but you start understanding that, like, somebody, when you're listening to music, you're like, oh, that's somebody doing this. And you're like, okay, so it's this many kick drums and this snare here and here. And you're like, oh my god, like, how do you write stuff like that? And then you go from there, you know, you start figuring out like simple things, like your drum kit doesn't sound the same as somebody else's drum kit, and you know, cymbals don't sound the same, and you start getting new cymbals and saving up for other things, and yeah, just falling in love with, you know, production and writing and recording. And yeah, as you say, like hearing those bands and being like, how do you write a drum part like that? Like,
then you listen to John Bonham and go, I'm never playing the drums again. Why do I even bother?
We're just like, he's the coolest fucking guy in the world. Like, why do I even bother? I think people like Travis Barker, like, influenced an entire generation for kids like myself to want to play drums. And and he's still doing it now, which is incredible. Like, still doesn't miss a beat. We played a festival with them a few years ago and watched them live, and I was just like, it's just staggering how good he is.
He looks like somebody that should play the drums. Like, it, the way he plays, it takes his whole body, but it looks like it's like you can see his soul. He's meant to play the drums. It's really
weird. He's totally born to play the drums. Totally. And I think, as I say, like, there's a reason it inspired so many kids in our generation to do it. You know, so many drummers in the rock and metal scene and punk scene will probably owe a lot of their careers to that man. And much like before, you know, I think, like, you know, with Ringo and with Bonham, I think, you know, drummers like that are the reason why he started doing it, you know, and there will always be these stars from these generations of people that are influenced by your past. I think, you're foolish not to look back there and sort of understand the history of it and why it's important to sort of honor those bands and not just be like, oh, they're shit, just because I don't get it. You know, it's just a waste of time to think like that.
There's a long history of lead singers that used to be drummers too. There's a lot of them.
We just hate being at the back. We have to be at the front. you start doing one too many fills, and everyone's like, "No, that's enough. That's enough now." with me, it was really interesting. I was in like three or four bands at the time, and I was working a job, and I would go to work, and then I would go and rehearse in the town where I worked. So I'd have to it was like a 40-minute train ride to where I worked because I lived in a little village. So I would take my cymbals and my snare drum every day, go to work, go to rehearsals, go home, do the same like 4 days a week. And, you know, I was just so desperate for any band that I was in to be able to go on tour or to be able to, you know, make that my life. And then I started another band because I wasn't tired enough. I was young. I still had energy with a few other friends from other bands and they needed a singer. And I'd done a few backing vocals for other bands that, well, I played drums in because nobody else wanted to do it. And I was like, I'll do it. I want to be at the front. And we started a band and we sounded kind of like that band Hopes Fall. It was like, like sort of melodic-y, dreamy, sort of post-hardcore-y pitched kind of vocals. And we got on a Bring Me the Horizon show. I think it was like one of their first headline tours or something. Or one of the first. It was a long time ago. The Architects had toured with Bring Me the Horizon. So my band opened for Bring Me at this really small show in Brighton. And the Architects were there. And their singer had quit the day before, or was it the day after? I think it was the day after. But they had just seen me performing with them. And the day after the show, Ali, that plays bass in the band, came into where I worked because we worked on the same street and was like, we would love it if you would come and try out for our band. And I was like, well, I can't play drums that fast. So I can't, because you have double kick and I couldn't play double kick. And he was like, no, you idiot. Matt's the singer. We want you to come and try out vocally. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. Fine. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I knew that. Absolutely. And from there, I was... It was a no-brainer for me. I hadn't met them all properly. Well, I had met them very loosely, but it was the fact that they had been on tour in Europe and the fact that they had toured with some bands that I loved. I was like, absolutely, like, count me in, let's go.
Do you remember the first song you ever wrote? Were you doing it even before you were in bands?
Yeah, I remember writing a song with my friend when I was like, when we first started writing music together, because he learned bass at the same time that I learned drums. And we wrote a song called Just Good Friends. And the lyrics were Just Good Friends, Just Good Friends. We met when we were three. And that was it. Just over and over and over again.
You guys need a Grammy for that.
Absolutely. It's sort of early Beatles influence, you know?
Yeah. I have to ask you this question because I ask all songwriters on the show this question. This is a songwriting craft question. Any genre, any artist, doesn't matter. But give me an example of a song that you think is perfectly written. A song that you covet that you think that is an example of perfect songwriting, but then you got to break down and break it down and tell me why.
I think Yesterday by the Beatles is just genius. I think actually, like, the story behind it and Paul saying that it came to him in a dream and that he heard the chords in his dream and then took it to the studio and was convinced it was somebody else and was like, who is this song? And was like playing it out loud. He didn't have the melody. He didn't have the word yesterday. So the lyric was scrambled eggs. So he was singing it saying scrambled eggs. And the rest of the band and George Martin and everyone else that was recording it was like, no, we've never heard this song before. This is absolutely fine. And then the fact that he just carried on playing it and was so convinced it was somebody else's, but then quickly realized that it was him and he had just written it in his sleep, basically. Well, the chords had come to him in a dream. And then now it's probably one of the most covered and successful songs of all time. And it was just, he just happened to have a piano by his bed when he woke up to remember it. I just think music really at its root is just very pure. And like, you know, it doesn't need to be overthought and there shouldn't be rules and what you should and shouldn't do. I think if you think something's brilliant and you haven't stolen it from someone, then you should push it. And I think, you know, that really, really shows, because it's just a genius song. I think, and again, it's so good because it's one of those songs that, again, just moves through generation to generation. It doesn't sound dated. It sounds like it could be on like a record now, you know.
Why don't I have dreams like that?
So I wish I had them as well.
Seriously.
I have a bit more money.
Yeah. We got to talk before you go about this record, because unlike any other album that Architects has released, this is the fruit of the plague, as we were joking about earlier, a time when the band had a lot of downtime to be able to focus on it, where normally in a band, you're kind of juggling touring. We got to get the record out and we got to do this and we got to do that. And so the engine gets shut off and they say, okay, you're home now. Did you enjoy having more time to work on a record, or did you find yourself overthinking the writing process because you had too much time?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think we'd already finished writing For Those That Wish to Exist just before the lockdown started. So that was really just recording it and finessing it. And then we just had so much time on our hands that it was like, well, let's just carry on doing what we're good at doing. And that was writing. At that time, we just felt like we were in a really strong form. And we just carried on. And it was just really fun. You know, because we never really set aside time to be like, this is when it needs to be done. This is what's going to happen. Nobody knew we were doing it. So we were just, you know, when we were allowed to be together, it was like, okay, let's book this time in the studio and go and, you know, work together and just have fun. And I think that's what people hear in the record. I think, you know, so much of music is to be taken so seriously. And if you're a heavy band, you've got to be this or that. And it has to have this and that. And I think really this record is just five people in the studio just having a really good time for the first time in a long time, actually just being a bit free and a bit just fun, because it's our band. We've been in it for 17 years and we've had a lot of ups and downs. And I think sometimes you've got to make these big jumps sonically to do things that you enjoy. And I think I love this record. I'm very proud of it. I think it's, but mainly I'm just proud of it because I listen back to it and I just remember all the fun moments and the silly bits from it. You know, not that I think the record's silly or anything like that. It's, you know, it's really heavy and the subject matter is really heavy, but I think actually just being five mates in a studio in the middle of the countryside in Devon, it's just a great record that is just always going to be in my mind of you know, for the rest of my life, that I loved that time.
I was going to say the symptoms of a broken spirit doesn't exactly reflect the fun you had in the studio. No. It's a pretty serious album title.
Yeah. It's pretty there. It's pretty on the nose, but I think it's just classically English. You know, you have to be a little bit sarcastic with it and go, oh, things are shit. What are you supposed to do? I can't change it. You know, you just got to get on with it and try and, you know, make each other laugh and big up people around you and, you know, spread that love.
I looked at your tour dates before I talked to you today and there are some gaps. Is there a North American, a US tour that's going to get announced soon, maybe?
I would hope so. We were so unfortunate with America. I mean, the first one we had to pull was literally right in the middle of everything. And then the second one we pulled because there was just no way to make it work. We were so desperately, frantically running around trying to get these visas sorted out, but everyone else in the world was trying to get to America. And it's like, at the end of the day, people need to understand that it's a business that we front, and we could have lost an insane amount of money if we hadn't have got those visas and booked everything and had gone out there, and we probably would have had to have gone and got jobs, you know. Whereas this way, we lost a lot of money, having to pull out of it. But we knew that it was the right decision to make, and the stress was really quite worrying. So it's not something we did lightly, but I just think we'll be back. I trust our American fan base to still be there, and everyone's been so lovely and supportive of and understanding. You know, there's so many bands that it's happened to, you know, our friends in Malevolence, North Lane, it happened to as well. It's just the doors are opening to a normal sort of touring world, but it's there's still parts that are, you know, that are a bit tricky. But yeah, we'll be back soon, and I think we're just buzzing to be back out there. You know, our whole team is in America. Everyone out there is so supportive, and I want to come over and just sort of be able to pop into every radio place that's supporting us and say thank you properly. You know, and that was one of the things that I mentioned to people when I was in Vegas. I was just like, I want to make this more of a proper relationship, you know, be able to like, be like, cool, we're coming through town. Do you want to come for a show? Let's go for a drink, and be able to just, you know, show people the actual appreciation of the support that they give us.
And especially just over the last couple of years too, the way that the podcast world has expanded because of the pandemic, having people hunkered down. I mean, now getting to work out of my own studio, it's like, it's nice and clean in here. It's nice.
It's so great. It's so great, isn't it? I love it. I have to jump off because I've got another phone call.
Shit, I got to let you go.
It's all right. I just didn't want to stop it because it was a really great interview.
Oh,
and who knows, maybe the one afterward isn't. So I was trying to enjoy it for the 10 extra minutes.
Well, it was really nice to meet you in Vegas. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the record. And when
you guys do
make it back to the States, I will see you then.
Absolutely. I really look forward to it. And thanks again for your support. It's really kind of you.
There he is, Sam Carter from Architects. The band's latest album, The Classic Symptoms of a Broken Spirit, is available everywhere. And, well, you're just going to have to keep an eye on the events calendar at mistresscarrie.com to find out when Architects finally release tour dates in North America sometime in 2023. If you're looking for Sam and Architects online, you can find all the links to their websites and social media in the show notes of this episode. You'll also find all the Mistress Carrie links as well. And you'll find the link to this episode's corresponding playlist. I make a playlist for every full-length episode of the Mistress Carrie podcast. It's filled with my guest music and also all of the artists and music that we referenced in the interview. If you liked what you heard, don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to the Mistress Carrie podcast. New full-length episodes come out every Wednesday, and every weekday, you get the Sit Rep. It's all your rock headlines, music news, and industry info in 5 minutes. Plus, you never know when we're going to release a bonus episode of the podcast. Don't forget to tackle all of your holiday shopping online at mistresscarrie.com. And join me every Tuesday night at 8:30 Eastern, live on my Facebook page for my video show, Cocktails in the War Room. The Mistress Carrie Podcast, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.